the best way to avoid deception is to educate yourself. And the company needs to invest in education in the area of sustainable development. And I normally say that try to develop an SDG strategy, a strategy for the sustainable development goals, because the SDGs or Agenda 2030, as they are also called, provides us with a great opportunity to understand this holistic cogwheel process, which sustainable development is all about. So the best way to avoid deception is educate yourself and the company to avoid falling into the trap of greenwashing. That's number one.
Welcome to the Leading Transformational Change podcast. Our passion is to help you lead and build heart-healthy organizations with a culture of purpose, trust, and integrity. My name is Tobias Sturason, and I'm the co-founder of Art Management. The two-week-long United Nations Climate Change Conference, COP26 in Glasgow, ended about 2 weeks ago. While I'm sure that many of us have followed some of the news, it can be hard to discern what were actual accomplishments and what would fall under the category of empty promises. A fundamental problem is greenwashing. The way both governments and businesses use PR agencies and strategies to tout their sustainability efforts in order to please voters, sell products, or recruit talent. Parul Sharma, a distinguished human rights lawyer, president of Amnesty Sweden, board member of financial institutions, and the CEO of the Academy for Human Rights in Business, has found that many companies spend more on communication around their sustainability initiatives than on the initiatives themselves. I wanted to talk to Parul about what we can learn from the COP26, the interconnectedness of issues like human rights, climate justice, and corruption, and how to avoid greenwashing. Parul has been the Vice President of Global Responsibility at Stora Enso, a 25,000-employee-strong paper manufacturing company, Head of CSR Compliance at a leading law firm, Chair of the Swedish Government's Agenda 2030 delegation, and Executive Director of Greenpeace Sweden. She is the author of 3 books on Agenda 2030. Before we jump into the conversation, I want to thank all of you who take the time to listen and even read and review this podcast. And I wanted to read one of the reviews we've received. This one is from Monica Muniz. Get pen and paper. These talks are full of valuable insights from extremely qualified speakers. Thank you so much, Monica. And to the rest of you, if you enjoy the conversation, we're so grateful if you take the time to rate and review it. It really helps us get this message out to more people. So now, without further ado, let's jump into my conversation with Parul Sharma. Parul, it's a privilege to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you very much, Tobias. It's great to be here.
First, I wanted to ask you a bit of a more personal question. Where did your passion for the subject of human rights begin?
Well, I'm rather sure that it started in quite a young age when I was around my teenage, like 13, 14 years of age. I had a strong sense for rights-based issues and felt very strongly for women's rights issues and child rights issues. And I think that mainly was my driving force, which then gradually led me into human rights and sustainability and climate justice related matters.
So you have a really impressive CV that spans work with numerous NGOs, businesses, and also government. And so perhaps one or a few stories of people that you've encountered along the way that have significantly informed your perspective on issues like human rights and climate change.
Sure. Well, first of all, again, thank you very much, Tobias. I think for me, the grassroots perspective is something which has always been with me as a part of my toolbox. when I work with whether it's companies, no matter what size of companies, or whether it's civil society organizations, or generally as an author, for instance, when I write books on the topic. And what do I mean by grassroots? Well, in my work, I've had the pleasure to actually be close to the people and to the communities, and sometimes to the land, which has suffered climate change, which has suffered the consequences of fraud and corruption, for instance, by sometimes multinational corporations or governments. Hence, I've been able to collect and gather a rather large and deep quantity of human testimonies on what happens when we don't take responsibility. So that has always, these stories and testimonies have always been the sort of guiding force for me, no matter where I work as an advisor or what I do. I always try and keep that in mind, that, you know, never forget why you are doing this, Parul. Never forget for whom you are doing this.
And I think that is such an important perspective, because I think we can easily kind of be lost behind the numbers and the papers and sitting in our offices, and we don't see the people, we don't see the situations. And I think what is, of course, on this podcast, we talk a lot about unhealthy culture and things like that, and a lot of my drive around that comes out of personal experiences and just seeing the negative effects of it. But I think in terms of what we're talking about today, the effects of corruption, having spent a lot of time in a country that is still quite in a global comparison, okay to do country like Ukraine, and having my wife who is from Ukraine, I've seen so much up close the effects of corruption, and you see the stories of people who, just because they were born in a different country than I am, have to struggle through their whole life, and they some of them very well educated, doing work that in Sweden or in many of the countries of our listeners would really pay a great salary, would kind of offer them a great life, and they still have to struggle, and they still have to spend their summers going to some other country picking berries, because that's kind of the way to make ends meet while they're working as doctors or lawyers. And what are, if, I mean, you talked about the importance of seeing the grassroots, and I'm just thinking, what are maybe one or two of the stories that have really kind of, that grounds you in the work that you do?
Well, first of all, what grounds me is the complexity of sustainable development, to start with, the complexity of human rights. And you mentioned some of them, that what corruption does to society. It impairs healthcare systems, educational systems. And like you, I've seen it with my own eyes. For me, at a very early stage, when I started off my work within sustainable development and human rights, the shocking fact was the collision between reality and the perception of the Western world on what kind of businesses we are doing in so-called high-risk countries. I was also on a daily basis rather shocked to see how we are doing business at the cost of human lives. For instance, companies with a beautiful branding, in a beautiful global branding, I would say, where you know that there have been efforts related to environmental standards, and, you know, related to recycling and so on and so forth, with a reputation which is maybe hard to compete with for other companies. When working on the land of production, where this company have its production, I rather quickly realized that, you know, it's easy to declare sustainable business in your own societies, meaning in the Western world, and at the same time compromising, for instance, paying off or behaving in a fraudulent manner towards an Indian environment department or environment agency or a Chinese department who is dealing with pollution control, for instance. There you're paying them off, but here at home in the Western part of the world, you're showing off a sustainable brand. Now, these things really got to me 20 years ago when I was fairly young in the business, and I couldn't understand how rest of the world couldn't see it. You know how you are when you're young. You think that what you have seen, you're the only one who's seen it. No one understands what you have witnessed. But for me, it was rather groundbreaking, and it formed my critique and my way of looking at sustainable development. So today, if a company or a government claims some sort of, take the situation of electric buses or electric cars, which is huge here in Sweden. Now, the fact that these electric cars and electric buses are dangerously produced in other countries and using batteries, which are both devastatingly produced for by other human beings, and has had a disastrous impact on someone else's ground reality and environment. How can you actually call such a solution sustainable? Because it's not really, but it's sustainable for the ones dealing with it in our setup. And these things still get to me. I hope I'm clear. But this imbalance of viewing sustainability and rather presenting incomplete pictures disturbs me a lot. And I've been carrying this disturbance now the past 20 years, I must say.
But so I'm thinking about that example of the electric buses, or if we think about electric cars today. And so there's, I guess, this need that we have, that we want to in some way navigate the complexity and in some way be able to say, okay, this is a good choice. Okay, I'm choosing to buy an And I totally understand that is a lot more complex than what we want to give it credit for. But how would you advise us to navigate those types of situations?
I think for the end consumer, to be very honest, I would just suggest for the end consumer to please kindly try and build as much knowledge as possible about the product you're buying, and especially if it's a car or a truck, then of course it's a huge investment for you, and there you need more ample knowledge on the sort of dangers behind the production. But to be very honest, the example of buses, electric buses and electric cars, for instance, for me it's a hidden trade-off, and I think many governments are pushing for such trade-offs today to support claims of being leading in green technology or green solutions or green investments. So at a government level, I think we as consumers and citizens need to understand that this is part of the government's PR as well. It sounds harsh, but what they are doing together with these companies is that they are suggesting that a product is green based on a single environmental attribute, isn't it? I mean, that's what they're doing. They are not giving us a holistic picture. So I think for me, this example is a hidden trade-off and part of one feature of greenwashing, for instance.
I think on that note, for example, if we think about the COP26 meetings in Glasgow that ended a little over a week ago, I think. I believe probably many in our audience have in some way followed a bit of the news, or I guess it's been impossible not to. But while politicians and perhaps business leaders want to tout the accomplishments and perhaps some of it is true and right, I've seen many people talking about a lot of empty promises that even countries might say, okay, this is our goal, but at the same time say that we are in no way bound to actually keeping to it. What's your perspective? Because I think for many of us, it's hard to navigate. It's hard to know what to believe. And even as you talk about the PR of government. So what is your perspective on what was really accomplished and what is perhaps more just words than actions? I understand that's a big question.
Well, Tobias, you're absolutely right. I mean, it is hard to navigate in this landscape because we are talking about heavy science here, and you need a certain amount of scientific knowledge. And for people like myself, it is difficult to navigate. It is difficult to follow. First of all, with this particular COP, with COP26, I must say that one positive thing which I reacted on was the fact that everyone, from citizens to organizations to even companies to media people, are more aware of empty promises. So people were more charged with the idea of, you know, don't give me empty promises, be concrete on what you want. So that shows a certain amount of risen knowledge, I would say, in the area of sustainable development. There were two things which I carry with me, which are of great heaviness for me. The first is that the term fossil fuels were used for the first time, which is shocking. And really, not to quote Greta, but she rightly said, what were you doing all the other COP meetings, you know, if you didn't even mention fossil fuels? And again, there was a compromise with regard to oil, coal and gas, which is a great botheration. I think the world saw another monster taking birth, which is India. We, on one hand, we are used to China and Brazil as being, you know, on the other side of the ring, but now we have another country partnering up with them, and that is India. And for such huge countries to be on the wrong side, I think we have a long way to go. Now, even important then, when you have such big countries on the other side, like India, Brazil, and China, who are not ready to take the full responsibility for fossil fuels to start with, and who have taken their role as emerging markets to a level which is of great danger, not only for mankind, but not only for humanity per se, with, you know, cheap labor and exploitation of laborers, but for the consequences of climate change. I think it's even more important that our financial institutions now take responsibility, and our financial investors react to this fact that, you know, if India, China, and Brazil are not going to take responsibility, then we need to have financial modules and financial systems to sort of hamper and act as a barrier to their whatever programs and whatever strategies for what they call the economic growth, whatever their strategies are. I think the financial sector need to be stricter and not use this as an opportunity for growth, but use this to be a barrier and someone who's blocking these three countries, you know, in their vision of being majestic fossil fuel countries.
Yeah, I mean, since that will seem, at least, I guess, costly in the short term, what do you think is the right driver, even as you work as a board member in a financial institution? What are some of the drivers to actually do the right thing?
You see, one thing is that there are many, you know, the three countries I've mentioned, they also have some sort of a movement, although maybe not as government supported as they should be. But for renewable energy, for example, Brazil, India, and China are huge in that area. India is the one country which can actually provide half the world with the kind of renewable energy, you know, we're looking at. So India could become a force in this area. And here, I think more support from financial institutions is something we need. More investors need to come front and support Indian entrepreneurs and Indian companies in this. And maybe then we can have the government understanding, you know, that this is also a very lucrative area, if you wish, for development. More coal mines and more coal industry is not the way, but, you know, the Indian government is stuck there, unfortunately.
And so when we talk about climate change, and we've started off talking about human rights and corruption, so I think that there's a case to be made and for that these issues are a lot more interconnected than we might often think, that what we do in one area, it impacts kind of all of these different aspects. Could you talk to that understanding?
Absolutely. You know, the interlinkages are so clear for anyone who's understood the gist of sustainable development. It's easy to talk about, you know, climate change and not realizing that it is indeed a human rights issue. As you're aware, a few weeks ago, some 22 organizations in Sweden, together with 3,000 Swedish citizens, approached the Human Rights Council in Geneva and with a petition against our pension funds, our public pension funds in Sweden.
Something that you took initiative to.
That was initially my initiative very much, but the 22 organizations and 3,000 Swedish citizens came together and we had a beautiful campaign where we wanted to generate public awareness about these holistic equations which you asked for now. I mean, our pension funds, we are talking about 2,000 billion Swedish kronas, which are invested in various projects. Now, it's a tragedy to call it investment, because if it's harming the planet, it's not an investment. But now I'm forced to use the language, because that's the sort of investment language used. But many of these projects where our pension money is invested in are oil, coal, and gas-based projects. And many of them have resulted in million of hectares of land which has been grabbed for these kind of projects. And millions of farmers, of fishermen are being forced out of their lands. We have examples from Ecuador and Mozambique and Brazil, where we see that, you know, indigenous people are suffering immensely. And in some countries, for instance, in Ecuador, some indigenous people have actually been subject for a kind of a commercial or capitalistic genocide where they no longer exist. So you tell me, you know, you find issues of biodiversity, you find issues of climate justice, human rights, child rights, right to livelihood. You know, you have a whole spectrum of tragedies here based on human rights and environmental justice, if you may. So I think we need to go into these kind of equations more and more to see that the most vulnerable and marginalized groups in the world are actually suffering the most from climate change. But our current investments through our financial institutions, whether it's private banking or public pension funds, they are actually still investing billions and billions of kroners and euros into projects which are harming the Amazonas, the rainforest, the Arctic, for instance. The our Swedish pension funds are still investing in harmful projects in the Arctic, for instance. So, you know, it's a matter of animal rights, human rights, climate justice, climate change. You know, you have it all there, biodiversity.
I think what you're also lifting there is that, I mean, some of these companies and these funds would call themselves sustainable. And you found in your research that many companies spend more on communication around their sustainability initiatives than on the actual initiatives themselves or on actually making real change. So I wanted to talk about this type of greenwashing and what you believe drives it.
Well, first thing, what drives it is lack of legislation. Today, it's okay, all right, to exaggerate your sustainability work because there are no consequences. But there are sort of legal frameworks coming in from the EU next year, hopefully, where you as a company will have to show a very high level of due diligence vis-a-vis human rights and environmental standards whenever you do business in high-risk countries. Such as the countries, some of them, which I have mentioned already. So there is change coming. But the other reason is, of course, that PR and communication agencies actually are in the forefront of building green brands. And that's one reason for why greenwash happens and why sustainability, unfortunately, has become an industry in itself, with empty promises and a lot of green curtains, as I call them. And I think here these PR agencies really have some soul searching to do, to be very honest, Tobias. Majority of consultants today within sustainability, this is really a fact in Sweden as well, have a background in PR and communication. So you tell me, if you have a background in PR and communication and you start off advising companies on sustainability with that background, what will the consequence be? Well, naturally, the consequence will be a PR activity because that's your expertise. But my firm have between 2017 and 2019, right before the pandemic hit us, we had some sampling done and made of, I think it was 150 companies here in the West world, most of them MNCs. And that sampling showed us that the budget-wise investments when it comes to sustainability are mostly done in the PR and the brand building and the communication departments of companies. And if you look at, for instance, procurement, let's take procurement or purchase in companies, these are the groups and segments in companies which have least investment in terms of budget and mandate and you know, any kind of knowledge growth which you would expect from a company of an MNC structure. So this is really indeed very difficult to digest, but it's a fact.
I'm thinking about an example of a company that I've been seeing, and I told you about that before the interview. It's where I saw that they were kind of touting themselves on big billboards in our city, showing that, oh, we've changed our packaging from something that was more environmentally or to something more environmentally friendly. And then they made this big campaign, and I probably spent many millions on promoting that change and patting themselves on the back.
Yeah, well, this is very common. This is also yet another feature of greenwashing, which I call the lesser evils feature. And what I mean by lesser evils feature is that companies apply a do-good label on an environmentally unfriendly product, basically. Or using a friendly product as a cover-up for an unfriendly majority product. For instance, oil and gas companies, even here in Sweden, promoting soya or vegan sausages at gas stations and making a big business out of it and a big PR machine out of it as an action to save environment, according to them. And this kind of a lesser evil approach in marketing is one of the most common types of greenwashing, which we see today. And And at the same time, it is encouraging, you know, that majority unsustainable practices, which we see, and which is then the reason to why we are where we are today. And again, they can do this because there is no legislation nor any sanctions connected to this kind of behavior. But it is changing. I mean, people are reacting now. 15 years ago, when I mentioned greenwashing or green curtains, people really reacted in a very negative manner, and, you know, really told me off. And sometimes I was treated as a party pooper, which is okay. But today, that is not the case. People do understand that, you know, there is something hidden between this kind of an exaggerated PR, which I find very interesting, because it's actually a shift of majority minds in my view. And this is also something which I then also recognized and realized during COP26, that the people look at things with another mindset now, which is good, I believe.
So I wanted to go back to the thing of that a lot of this, that a lot of the kind of sustainability aspect that it's driven, or the actors are coming from the PR marketing communications area. And I see something similar in terms of work that is done on organizational values and things like that, that is also often very driven by organizations that are communications or PR firms. And again, I don't want to bash communications and PR firms, because I do think that they have a very valuable work,
leave me to that.
Yes, I'll leave the bashing to you. but I personally have a background within communication, and actually actually looking at how I felt that communication was very dishonest was what led me to kind of focus more, because I saw that there were cultural issues that were not addressed. But anyway, I mean, speaking to that, so we have this that is kind of driven by PR communications agencies or practitioners. And then we have, and something that I think is very relevant to a lot of our listeners, which is now, of course, we talk about the great resignation, or whatever you want to call it. There's a big kind of fight for talent. And we talk about we need to communicate to Gen Z, and Gen Z, they want to have a purpose, and they want to and they care about these issues, and they want companies that take a stand. And then connected to that, we have the trend of employer branding and all of that. And again, while there might be good intentions, and of course I truly believe in the power of a true business purpose, but of course we have, I think, a lot of things that are actually driving it to become even more just focused on making us look like a good organization, kind of keeping up appearances while not actually dealing with the underlying issues.
True.
And maybe that has an adverse effect, because instead of us just, because it becomes this kind of fight that we have to look better than each other.
Yeah. Yeah, it has an adverse effect, but I think that the new generations now, with their critical mind and with also an increased knowledge on the holistic aspects of sustainable development, where they understand how one thing actually impacts another, and how environment and human beings are into a cogwheel process when we talk about sustainable development. So I have a lot of hope in this new generation. But the fact remains that today the political leadership and also the commercial leadership is in the hands of not so much the new generations, but the old generations who have been doing business in a wrongful way for a very long time, and who maybe are one of the main reasons to why we are facing these climate change, which we are. I do have a lot of hope in this generation, but change needs to be made now, because we are in a hurry, and I don't want to create a panic. No one wants to create a panic, but we need sharp and shrewd decision making when it comes to certain corporations, and especially those who are in the business of emitting fossil fuels, for instance. And here we also need a more targeted, a more goal-oriented financial market, which we don't have today. So there also, there's a lot of, you know, greenwashing going on, or rather, there is now a stream of sustainability work which is called the light green stream of sustainability work, where financial funds or banking the banking sector actually can claim that they are sustainable, but they are actually working with what we call light green sustainability, which is actually as harmful as any other business. But this is also, you know, to cover up what they're actually doing with their financial tools. There was a screening there was a screening made just a few weeks ago where Swedish funds came out as top greenwashers in Europe. I don't know whether you saw it. They do it because of the new EU rules, the Sustainable Finance Disclosure Regulation, which has built in a light green opportunity into its regulations. And it was calculated that 92% of Swedish capital fund is classified as light green. And what is light green then? I've used this word so many times now, but light green could be investments such as oil extraction in the Arctic region or deforestation in the Amazonas, or arms exports to the military regime in Myanmar, for instance. And this is extremely serious, because what the EU is now doing through its new regulation, it's actually enabling the financial market to keep on business as usual. How on earth can you be light green at the same time you're dealing with oil extraction in the Arctic region, for instance? So, you know, there are many aspects with where we need to be alert now. Societies need to be very alert. We need to apply critical thinking. We need to not to react on face value, but to actually dig further and understand what all these terms and regulations actually are doing. And I do think that a lot more focus on the financial markets will help us to direct the, because where the money goes, the decision goes, isn't it? So if we can actually make the financial markets to understand that, you know, there is nothing called light green. There's only green or dark green. That's where we have to go. Nowhere else.
So if you would, I mean, speaking to leaders and HR and also ethics professionals that listen, I think for most organizations where they might work, dealing with all the different issues of human rights, corruption, climate impact, and so on, that, as we've said, it is complex. There's a lot of decisions that are going to be needed to be made, and many things might take time, and it might take time to change. For example, if you haven't had control over your supplier chain, And you start that work, and you start like looking for the red flags instead of kind of just overlooking them and so on. I mean, of course, that is work, and that takes time. So what I'm thinking is, what is a better way for organizations, both in terms of when recruiting people, in their communication and so on, to communicate, to be more honest about what are we doing? What are we still needing to do? And to be able to kind of break that goodness image or greenwashing.
See, I always say that the opportunity for dishonesty lies in the lack of knowledge. So my first advice to companies is research. But the best way to avoid deception is to educate yourself, isn't it? And the company needs to invest in education in the area of sustainable development. And I normally say that try to develop an SDG strategy, a strategy for the sustainable development goals, because the SDGs or Agenda 2030, as they are also called, provides us with a great opportunity to understand this holistic cogwheel process, which sustainable development is all about. So the best way to avoid deception is educate yourself and the company to avoid falling into the trap of greenwashing. That's number one. Today, I would say it's more important because consumers, as we said, are more aware, they're more alert, they have a stronger critical sort of feature in the way how they look at pretty packaging, and they don't buy all sustainability claims anymore. So you have to really obtain knowledge for your own sake and for your stakeholders' sake. And talking about stakeholders, the other suggestion I normally give companies is involve your stakeholders in this process. It can be difficult to have control over all the working facets of a company, from suppliers to investors to people's priorities. That can differ quite a lot when we look at sustainability values. But here, you will have a much more vibrant SDG strategy if you do this. Another thing is be open to receiving feedback. I think opening up a line of communication with customers is one way of gaining awareness on how the brand's claims are satisfying the customers. Receiving feedback is also extremely valuable for the company for, you know, futuristic processes. Above all, I would say it enables gaining an outsider's perspective on how a product is perceived. And be open and transparent on where you are producing your products and your services, where you are purchasing the same from. Because this is one area where I would say we are suffering from a huge lack of transparency. Procurement, whether it's public procurement or private procurement by private sector. Because if you look at the OECD countries, most of the richest countries in the world are purchasing products and services from so-called high-risk areas and really doing nothing, close to nothing, when it comes to the environmental impact on, for instance, water or air or the human impact when it comes to exploitation on laborers and labor, maintaining labor standards.
So when we talk about positive examples, I think one example that often comes up is a company like Patagonia and that have kind of had this as a part of the way they do business and so on. But if we look beyond that, because I think so many times it's just the same example all over or over and over again. If you think about an example of a company that you feel have kind of started, that didn't start from a point of being perfect, but just and that probably aren't perfect because no one is, I would say, but that have taken some important steps that have inspired or impressed you.
See, let's start with, as you said, Patagonia and even Body Shop. Now, why are they always referred to as good examples? It's not because they have 100%, you know, a crystal clear strategy, or maybe they have a 100% crystal clear strategy on where they want to be in 10 years and in 20 years. But they are also extremely transparent on where they are today and what they're not doing and why they're not able to do it. So that transparency makes them, you know, rise in the popularity index, which is far from greenwashing, actually. They are using the right opposite methodology. So that's Body Shop and Patagonia. But I have had the privilege and pleasure of working with family-owned companies for many years. I think many family-owned companies, globally speaking, comes within the ambit of medium-scale companies, medium-scale-sized companies. And I've seen that family-owned companies have most of the time a strategy which is more of the kind we see with Patagonia and Body Shop, and also a deep fear for their brand, because the brand is most of the times linked to their ancestors or their family name or through something which was a value-based venture to start with, values which they need to keep hold on to because that is how the company started. So I see many such successful stories. For instance, here in Sweden, now this is a very Swedish example, but Löfbergs, for instance, earlier called Löfbergs Lila, but Löfbergs Coffee, family-based business. Now they are constantly struggling with being on track with what is necessary from a climate and environmental perspective, being on track on what is what should be regarded as fair trade linked to their products. But they're also very open with what they're not able to do 100% and what they have not able to, what the sort of sustainability areas where they have not invested in. So that honesty, I think, is something which makes me comfortable as a consumer as well. I react when I see these new compensational companies, which says that if you buy a hamburger from us, we will plant 10 trees, somewhere on the African continent. I fear these companies. I fear that they have taken an approach which is too simple, where the consumer, the daily consumer, is not informed that this kind of a mathematics which you are presenting is not a matter of plus minus zero. It's actually still a matter of minus for the climate. So I think such companies are using what I call a vagueness, because that's another feature of greenwashing, where you are on purpose being very non-specific about your production and your raw material and how much your raw material is actually harming. A hamburger is definitely not equal to 10 trees on the African continent, for instance.
I think that there's often an enmity between NGOs and corporations, or some form, maybe not enmity, but some form of conflict, where business leaders might see NGO leaders as a bit of naive activists, and NGO leaders perhaps see corporate leaders as only caring about the bottom line. And we've had Bob Langert on this podcast before. He was the former VP of social responsibility at McDonald's, who shared how they started to collaborate with their critics like Greenpeace and the Environmental Defense Fund to improve their practices. And however, I think that this type of collaboration is very unusual. And what I wanted to ask you, as you are kind of representing both worlds, both very, very much a leader in the nonprofit field and a leader in the business field, what are some things that you think leaders on both sides can do to foster more productive relationships and to collaborate better or?
I think, Tobias, I see a lot of collaboration going on today with certain kind of NGOs, like Save the Children, for instance. They have a program now, an established program and a model for how to work with companies on child rights issues, for instance, and how to implement the business principles and child rights into their company's operations. But I also feel that even if there is a collaboration, I think NGOs should be careful with how they market that collaboration, because working with Save the Children is not a sign off for a company being brilliant in human rights issues, or they understand what land grabbing does to communities around the world, and that, you know, it's watertight. So I think there, I feel sometimes that some NGOs, some organizations rather, might be a bit naive when they cooperate, but that cooperation is extremely important nevertheless. So when UNICEF and Save the Children work with companies, I think it's very good. The only heads up is be careful in how you market that, but that doesn't mean that, you know, the whole thing is over and done with when it comes to companies' work on human rights, for instance. Then when it comes to these sort of difficult NGOs, I think that the 22 NGOs which are behind this petition to the UN, the Human Rights Council in Geneva, that companies might regard them as the difficult NGOs, like Friends of the Earth and so on and so on, FIAN, for instance, or certain Africa groups or Latin America groups. The need for watchdogs is real today. We need independent NGOs, because there's some brilliant data produced by these NGOs, which we need, which will never be produced by companies or you know, the bottom line operators, because their interest is only profitability, or rather the main interest for them is profitability. So I think we need these watchdogs very much. Then if companies are open to guidance from these NGOs, well and good, but that's not the job of NGOs, to be very honest. They are human rights defenders, they're environment defenders. That's their job, that's their task, and that's their calling. But if companies now, I've noticed one thing which is rather troubling, and that is the more often the doors are closing to NGOs from company side than opening up. There is a severe non-response nowadays when NGOs approach companies to seek a meeting and seek a response and answers to a catastrophe or a tragedy. So I would say that European companies are maybe turning more and more like North American companies who have had this approach for very many years. But then there are also some good examples, as I gave you, Save the Children and UNICEF, for instance.
To use a bit of a biblical word, I guess we need a bit of the prophets in that sense, who are ready to call things out. And yes.
Yeah, and you know, it's not easy. The survival of these NGOs is not easy, because the market is becoming tighter and tighter, and their survival is. These NGOs also work on volunteerism, and it's not an easy lifestyle, to be very honest. But I must say that the research presented by these organizations, who are also in high-risk countries, who are there when the bulldozer comes and you know, wipes out villages, wipes out districts, these NGOs are there. They see it, they document these tragedies, and they deliver it to the corporations and to governments. I mean, it's extremely important for us today. And the situation of human rights defenders and environment defenders, it has never been as bad as it is today.
So, Parul, thank you so, so much for taking the time for this conversation. I think it's been incredibly insightful and helpful. And as a last question, I just wanted to ask you how people can connect with you and follow your work.
Please feel free to connect with me on all social media. I'm on LinkedIn, on Facebook, on Instagram. So you'll find me there, Parul Sharma, Sweden. I think I'm easy to find in Sweden, but if you look for Parul Sharma in India, you will have a lot more challenges, because there are several million Parul Sharmas there.
and would also recommend our Swedish listeners to get your book on Agenda 2030.
Actually, there are three books now, one for schools and educators, one for companies and governmental agencies, and the third is for all of us who wants to make a change and maybe, you know, work on some behavioral change connected to sustainable development. So
thank you.
Thank you, Tobias.
My name is Tobias Sturason, and I'm the co-founder of Art Management. The two-week-long United Nations Climate Change Conference, COP26 in Glasgow, ended about 2 weeks ago. While I'm sure that many of us have followed some of the news, it can be hard to discern what were actual accomplishments and what would fall under the category of empty promises. A fundamental problem is greenwashing. The way both governments and businesses use PR agencies and strategies to tout their sustainability efforts in order to please voters, sell products, or recruit talent. Parul Sharma, a distinguished human rights lawyer, president of Amnesty Sweden, board member of financial institutions, and the CEO of the Academy for Human Rights in Business, has found that many companies spend more on communication around their sustainability initiatives than on the initiatives themselves. I wanted to talk to Parul about what we can learn from the COP26, the interconnectedness of issues like human rights, climate justice, and corruption, and how to avoid greenwashing. Parul has been the Vice President of Global Responsibility at Stora Enso, a 25,000 employee strong paper manufacturing company, head of CSR compliance at a leading law firm, chair of the Swedish government's Agenda 2030 delegation, and executive director of Greenpeace Sweden. She is the author of three books on Agenda 2030. Before we jump into the conversation, I want to thank all of you who take the time to listen and even read and review this podcast. And I wanted to read one of the reviews we've received. This one is from Monica Muniz. Get pen and paper. These talks are full of valuable insights from extremely qualified speakers. Thank you so much, Monica. And to the rest of you, if you enjoy the conversation, we're so grateful if you take the time to rate and review it. It really helps us get this message out to more people. So now, without further ado, let's jump into my conversation with Parul Sharma. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, it really means the world to us if you would share, rate, and review it on iTunes. We're super grateful for all the 5-star reviews and generous comments that we received so far. It really helps us take the message of purpose and integrity to a wider audience. And finally, don't forget to grab your free PDF on leadingtransformationalchange.com. See you in 2 weeks.